side too. Okay. Let's shift gears a little bit and review your involvement with some of the space efforts and studies here at RAND.
Okay, I joined RAND in 55, and I soon became aware that we were doing a lot of quite far out work for the time in space. I noticed a man named Hans Lisk, one of our engineers, who spent his livelong day making moon trajectories, designing various ways to get to the moon. Al Lang, who was designing probes, lunar probes.
Is it L-A-I or
L-A-N? L-A-N-G, Lang. But mostly I came in contact with Bob Buckheim, a very amusing and competent guy. Perfect, I thought, for leading projects in this area. I was really overwhelmed that anyone would be paid to work in space. It seems like such a dazzling thing to do. I was very naive in those days. But I said to Buckheim one day, really, don't you feel great about being on top of these lunar projects? And Bob's reply was, it's a living. An understated reply. I knew he was excited about it too. But he was very good at it. We were doing a lot of lunar work. Everyone knows that we have a feedback series from the 54-55 area, still not open to the public, but mentioned everywhere in the public press. I hope that it will be cleared one day. It was an overall study of the space environment.
Did you indicate previously that this had been submitted for classification review?
Several times. I mean, it has been submitted several times.
Right.
And in each case, it was thought inopportune to give it to the public. I'm not sure why, but at any rate, though it's mentioned in many books and articles. But the lunar work was going ahead. And I can recall that in October 4th, 1957, when Sputnik went up, the excitement that followed. I happened to run into Al Lang at a drugstore that day, and he could hardly contain himself. He was really overthrown by the fact that the Soviets had got there first. Buckheim and others, Chuck Heffern and a good many others, were turning to try to bring American space science up, and I'm sure it was happening all over the country, but it was especially keenly felt here. Joe Krieger in our physics department had predicted Sputnik aiming at a certain date in late September, he thought, an anniversary date for a great Russian space scientist, Tsiolkovsky. It came a few days later, but Krieger was on the money. Well, Sputnik was very exciting. I can remember when Scientific American first reported it in great haste. They spelled the word Sputnik several ways in their article, something that an elite publication like Scientific American never does. But they were obviously in a hurry. In late 58, RAND was asked by the House subcommittee on astronautics and space exploration under John McCormick, Representative McCormick, to put together a handbook on space, a one-volume look at what space entails. The amusing thing is that we were given only 3 weeks in which to do this. Bob Buckheim took on the project with gusto, and two other editors and I did the editorial and coordinational work with Bob. He was decisive and quick and always available, and we were able to shorten the lines of communication readily. We had ourselves a book, a fairly sizable book, in 3 weeks. The difficulty was that this came at about the time of our meetings with the RAND Board of Trustees, and there was no official, no management person available to deliver this to the House. So I was asked to do that myself. So away I trudged with the Space Handbook under my arm and went into the congressional offices of the subcommittee. I met with Charles Sheldon, who was an old civil servant and a very fine space buff and administrator, and sat down with a group of five or six staff members that he headed. And I explained what we tried to do in the Space Handbook. It was interesting to see their response. It was, I would call, a muted response. And I found out a few days later what caused that. The House subcommittee was very disappointed by RAND's performance in the Space Handbook. Not that it wasn't the best thing going, which it was. It was a very fine book. It's just that they had expected something else. And I began to get a sense of that as the week went on. Finally, toward the end of the week, they showed me what they had. I hadn't realized it, but the subcommittee had asked industry as well as RAND to make a study of space. And the industry had come up with all the gee-whizzery that you can imagine. Industry had turned to with a vengeance. It had airbrush drawings in color. It had people in space suits. It had every conceivable kind of rocket arcing to the moon. We were competing with Douglas and Lockheed, North American Aviation, and all of the others for the attention of this subcommittee. I didn't realize it until toward the end of the week. They said they didn't want to make me sad, but they said, look what industry did. And they put it on the table, and I must say it was the most gorgeous set of color airbrush drawings that you could imagine.
They were looking for sort of practical things that said, we can do the job now, just give us the money sort of thing.
Yeah, practical may not be the operative word here. They wanted impressive things. They wanted to suggest practical endeavor, but they did it through this rather gorgeous display. Well, RAND, we had very few illustrations. It was all black and white, and it was much more narrative than this imaginative prose. It was a straightforward accounting of the difficulties, the promises of space. Actually, of course, there was no real competition between the two at all. Ours was much the better report. And when it got out of the staff and into the subcommittee, it proved to be that. But for a while, I was met with disappointment on the part of the staff who were expecting really something gorgeous and got instead a very factual, academic bit of prose about space.
What were they expecting in terms of content rather than just presentation?
Oh, I suppose they wanted guidelines, a direction for space. We called it a handbook, which meant it was a resource book or a place where you could look to find answers about libration points and speed velocities and designs of probes and so on. But they were obviously looking for, they wanted somebody to point them in a direction and say, do this, go in this direction, and here are the gorgeous things that you can get if you do. We didn't make, we were not persuading. We had no persuasive prose in there at all. But in fact, historical treatment of space, a careful laying out of the hardware of space and some of the difficulties of space flight, the dynamics of space flight. But we didn't try to guide, we didn't try to persuade, we didn't try to sell, essentially. Industry was selling, it was on the make. And that was not more transparent than that day with that committee.
Well, certainly through the 50s, Rand, if not attempting to sell, had certainly promoted and pushed for the idea of space activity. So there was a sense in which Rand was interested in seeing this happen. I guess
definitely. Yeah. Oh, definitely. We felt keenly about space and space research. No, I'm thinking of the Jim Crackery, the neat things you could do, and industry was concentrating on those. It was flamboyant. It was, and it had very little content beyond that. Ours was had depth and authority. Oh yes, we were very deep into space, and we stayed that way. The book was well received by the committee, and then of course it was put into a commercial book by Random House, and then revised in some years later, and still in the mid-60s it was on the Random House list, and it was picked up in translation too. I have a Spanish edition. It is now highly regarded, considering the effort. It was, from my point of view, a very exciting effort. I remember dictating parts of the book over the phone, passages that were actually set in type later. Just it was going that fast. But the Buckheim and company were interested in boosters, and continued that. We, in the days of the 60s, headed toward the moon landing in 69, we were not immediately involved. I think the exciting parts for me were in the late 50s and early 60s. And then industry and NASA seemed to take over heavily with the lunar, Apollo work.
Did NASA turn to Rand after its formation and ask its help to conduct studies? And
we did a fair amount of NASA work, yes. It didn't come until after Sputnik, though. We had done work for NACA, the predecessor organization, the aeronautics group. But our work, you see, we had been Air Force with a very small quantum of atomic energy until the late 50s. And then ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency, came in. And NASA very soon after that, I would say by the early 60s, we had NASA work. I haven't looked back on the NASA work, but we did have a fair amount of it. Don't know what else there is to say about the space work, except that in its heyday at Rand, it was the best thing going. I thought it fitted neatly into what I thought was an exciting program.
You mentioned that Rand did have some work with NACA. Were you familiar with that activity?
Only in a sense. I saw the work we did to get the bottle shape on the 100 series fighters. You know, there was some disappointment about the speeds that were achieved with a prototype fighter. And the bottle shape, I can't recall the exact expression that was applied at the time, but we were close to that to help achieve speeds. We did a lot of work on the larger bombers, work like studying re-engineing of the B-47s, for example, what you could do if you were to put a more powerful engine on, how that could be accommodated. We were looking at nuclear power plants for aircraft, and we had quite a study at one time. It never seemed feasible, if I remember correctly, to do that. There was a weight problem and other kinds of dangers with having a nuclear power source aboard an airplane. We have, there was in the early 50s, or no, I'm sorry, in the early 60s, there was talk about a long-range airplane, one that would stay aloft for days, rather like the one that's been flying recently. And we tried to feed into that study. We liked the idea of a long-distance aircraft, one that would be aloft as much as a week, I think we were talking about at the time. We had designers, people working with ceramics to aircraft structures, working with beryllium and titanium to get, again, structures to get the lightness and strength simultaneously. We were fairly close to the aircraft picture. I can remember in 58 when the first commercial jets were flying, one of our aircraft engineers flew on the DC-8, would it have been?
It would have been a DC-8, yeah.
And came back full of wonder at the 60-second takeoff runs and so on. It really frightened him. He was used to the old propeller craft. Yes, the aircraft were a good part of our work. We looked at airfoils. You saw in the Life magazine a special airfoil with a tube.
Right.
We pursued that for a while. And designs. Engines were always big.
Okay. Let's sort of conclude with a kind of your perception of the evolutionary changes that RAND has gone through since you've been here. Just sort of your feel for the sense of the place, perhaps organizationally, anything that sort of lends to change of character over time.
Well, I think one has to say that RAND is still the best game in town, but it has changed. Keystone of RAND is the freedom that it gave its people. The staff were almost utterly free to pursue projects of their own. We would pursue them and then see what happened. It was that freedom that was especially valued then. I think we've lost some of that, maybe a lot of that. There's been an overlay of administrative detail in later years. I think it's been necessary. As we went to a matrix organization, we took up domestic studies, all of a sudden we found ourselves with, we're covering practically all the azimuths of the human experience, except perhaps the humanities. And we needed to keep that under control. Things are a lot better understood than they were. Just to touch on a few other publications, the publications effort was amateurish here, really. But we depended heavily on commercial publishers, typesetters. They did a good job for us. The product is good looking, but generally things were pretty amateurish. We used crude materials and Ozolid machines, and xerography was known by the 50s, but it did not come in until much later at RAND. So today, in publications at RAND, we see a very sophisticated outlook. The present head of our department is really on top of the technology, and we're really out ahead. In those days, we were kind of fumbling. RAND, in the early days, was heavy on science and engineering. Social scientists were in the Washington office and then came here later and joined the body of RAND and grew steadily until they became perhaps its most important component. I feel that the there's been a tidal drift away from engineering and the hard sciences toward the soft sciences, with a fairly steady focus on economics. And the economics work is really the language of economics. The products of economics are really central to our work now, and that I think is a change. We have a younger staff now. RAND started with young staff and a few old timers, and then there was a slow growth in age, the average age of our staff. But now we have a lot of young people, a lot of women now. It was a male, pretty much an old boy, boys or men's club back in the 50s when I joined. Only a few female members of the staff. I think that makes for a change. Minority groups, we've conscientiously sought to get minority members of our research staff. That's been slow, but there has been some progress there. RAND used to hire a man to keep us out of the press, a man named Manny Berlinroot in New York City had as his sole job to stamp out any mention of RAND in the press and put out bonfires and generally make sure that we were not noticed. That has flipped over. We now have a public information office that actively puts out press releases. We have a newsletter that reaches quite a large audience about our research products. So our orientation, our outward vision of the world is much keener than it was in those days. RAND in the early days, if I read it correctly, was something of an old boys' school. We have elite intellectuals who know one another, who know people in government, who have an invisible college going all the time. With a phone call, can reach a person who was a fellow student at a university. The hiring of RAND people was done by word of mouth. We had a personnel department, but it did not function very strongly in the hiring of research people. Research people came by the old boy network. So you start with an elite group, very bright people. You extend that network, and you operate at that level. And that happened for years. And then things got different. We see a more of a bureaucracy now at RAND. Things get attended to that were never attended to in the old days. But at the same time, there has been a closing down of some of the freedoms. I feel that at heart, RAND remains the same. I like RAND's view of life. I like the freedoms. I like the permissiveness of RAND. People can say what they will. They're free to ask dumb questions. I feel that that's a valuable thing to happen. You know, in an academic setting, you have so much to defend. You know, if in a conference, you're really on your own. And if you misstate yourself or omit some important fact, you have instant humiliation. There's a great deal of what the British call side, self-promotion at work in the academic world. I've seen it. RAND was without side. Our people, they were funny, highly amusing. They would say anything. The president, if he didn't understand something at a briefing, would ask an elementary question that would be hooted down somewhere else, but he would just ask it. There was no hesitation about this. I like that openness. We have a little less of that now. If I were to summarize it, I would say that we have a gorgeous innovation in intellectual the intellectual building of a research organization. It has perforce narrowed somewhat over the years, but the idea is still governs the freedom of the individual to run with his ideas. It's admittedly a little more difficult, but it can still happen. The great personalities of the 50s, the Kahns and the Wohlstetters, we don't see as many of those. We don't see Charles Lindbergh in the halls. Von Neumann is not here. But we have young people who are doing good things. I think that Rand I think it has a good future. We're talking about nearly 40 years of survival in a tough environment, and it's remarkable how it has kept on. We now have a solidity, a growing budget, and really I think that we're in pretty good shape. If we can protect some of the freedom, that's the only thing that, that I guess I'd be troubled about. The freedom of a person to break through the lock of procedures, the necessary bureaucratic procedures. It takes a big person to do that, but I think they'll be coming along. We have good young people doing that now, and it's still fun at RAND to break in on a conference and to listen to ideas exploding around the room. Suddenly you sense that nothing has really changed that much. As long as we get these people in, they're going to make their mark. So I have to end on an upbeat about it. I'll be retiring in February of 87 after 31 years. I thought I would go a little short of my 65th, but been a grand experience, and I think it's, well, Francis Bacon used to talk about an institute, the ideal institute, the New Atlantis, and RAND seems to me to come as close as anything I've seen to that kind of place.
Just to sort of touch a couple extra bases here, why was RAND so concerned about maintaining a low profile early on?
It was, I think, owing to the personality of Frank Kolbaum, our first president. He kept a low profile. As I understand it, that was just his way of working. He just did not want us exposed to the winds of the press. He just didn't want any part of that. And he dealt with people in government, the Department of Defense, easily and with straight lines. And he just didn't want to be arguing in the press, have something bouncing back on us from that direction. So he kept out of the public eye. Kolbaum was a I think he is the answer to many questions about RAND. He was an assistant to Arthur Raymond, I believe, and was a test pilot, or had to do with test engineering and aircraft. And he has a hard-headed, no-nonsense way of looking at life. I've seen him many times in briefings. His questions were always good. He was, but he had strong opinions. But the thing about Cobom is that he's freed from the academic trammels. You know, he didn't have a degree. That was one outstanding thing about him. He hadn't completed his undergraduate work at Wisconsin. In the early days, people hesitated even to call him president. He was known as the director of RAND. The trustees were looking for a gray eminence. You need a gray eminence when you start something this big. And they searched the Eastern Seaboard for university presidents and people who could bring prestige to RAND. You know, they wanted a person of outstanding character from the academic world. Well, after trying and being denied by many, they settled on retaining Cobom, as I understand it, with the title of president. And he proved to be absolutely outstanding. In framing RAND from 48 till his retirement around 1965, he just he found it to be an amusing menagerie of people, and he walked quite freely in and out of the cages and kept everything in order. His personality had a soothing effect, but he could be tough, I understand. That's the best I can make of that question. He didn't want RAND's and the government's and the country's problems to be batted out in the press. He wanted them to be done quietly, to be handled quietly. And he insisted on that, and so we kept a low profile. We did try a little institutional advertising in Fortune and Scientific American in the 50s, but we all felt a little shamefaced about that, and it didn't really come to anything.
When you were talking about the special sense of freedom here at RAND, I think another element that plays into that is sort of the external environment, your relationships with contracting agencies and what they demand. Certainly, I think over time, at least in our experience as we study the history of space, the bureaucratic agencies, NASA, the Air Force, have themselves become more bureaucratic and more demanding of the people that they contract. And I'm sure that that's had an effect on RAND.
Yes, in publications we see it when we take on a new contract. That agency will send us a book saying, you will publish in this fashion. You will do that. See? When you give us a report, it must look this way. Well, we have always resisted this kind of thing. We like to put our own imprints on things. We like to control our own distribution. We have a sophisticated publication shop here, so we try to cope with this in an amiable way, with the demands of these contracting agencies, government mostly, who insist on form. It's usually a form rather than substance. Our contracting people have fought the good fight for us, I think. Those people are all gone now. I'm speaking of the early treasurer, head of finance of those early days, and they had to hammer out contracts with parts of government and insist on our rights. RAND's had a way of cocking a snoot at things, of just sort of thumbing its nose at bureaucracy. We insisted, for example, on flying first class on the airlines for years, and we didn't give it up until the late 60s, when it became just too burdensome. Nobody was helping us at all. We had to take it out of the extra money out of fee, and it didn't really seem to be doing much for us, because it meant for an occasional embarrassment when the head of Lockheed would, or the chairman of the board at Hughes would be sitting in the coach section of the airplane, and our junior research people would be in the first class, and that began to look a little silly. our cost analysts finally turned that off. But Rand, it's odd to think how cocky it was in those days, you know, flying first class, always dealing with the top, dealing in at the top, being overlooking the usual steps up the ladder. We were remarkable, I think. But I think it was true. We had it was an elite group, and they were used to dealing at that level. And I imagine that some of the things are still not well known. Our contributions at the highest levels of government are still not widely known. We have we've had our critics, you know, heavy criticism from the academic community, and I've had a kind of running dispute with Jerry Peel, the publisher of Scientific American, who has been on our backs quite a lot.
What are the nature of some of these criticisms?
Oh. That in talking about thermonuclear war, we're inviting thermonuclear war. It's that familiar fallacy, but it certainly meant a lot. And I know that Peel and his people, you know, they're quite serious. And he's a fine writer and lecturer. You know, he has many books, and they all seem, or many of them seem to come to this point that Rand is an invitation to disaster. We really can't be lend credibility to the possibility of a thermonuclear war. Any step, even studying it, is a way of giving it credibility.
Well, how does Rand absorb this kind of criticism? It just sort of come in and sort of roll off their backs, or is there some situation which they sort of say, well, maybe we should pause and think about this. Does this have validity?
It's an interesting question. I have not heard that particular thing discussed. You know, I knew it through Peel, and I read it in his magazine. I knew I was aware of it, but I've not heard it discussed much here. I would like to think that we could cope with that. I've always felt that the things Rand needed to keep its yeast going here, to keep things active intellectually, was besides the research staff, I felt that we should have a bishop who would be paid to do nothing but walk around the halls in his episcopal robes. You know, I think we would need a poet. A poet on the order of, E.E. Cummings, let's say, who would simply have a place and write, talk, criticize. I think having a child around Rand. In other words, I would like us not to be take ourselves too seriously, but keep an open mind, even for our critics. I would love to see that perfect kind of freedom. I bring the bishop in because there's a whole body of philosophical thought that doesn't really enter into Rand research. There's knowledge there that has truth in it, and we don't examine that, or don't examine it sufficiently. The poet, I think we need the insights that a poet provides, the sharply erratic ways of arriving at ideas. I've seen it in a few poets that I've met. There's something there, and I think we need it. So I've always hoped that we could get these three persons to come to Rand, but of course we haven't.
Well, I guess it's a large question how those three archetypes can sort of fit into a bureaucracy, and that's, I guess, one of the present dilemmas.
And the interesting thing is that I couldn't imagine it in the present Rand, but I could imagine it in the Rand of the 50s.
We're winding down to the last part of this taper. Just as a last sort of thought, it seems to me that in the contracting process now, there's a lot more political pressure involved, a lot more political direction coming from, say, the Department of Defense towards the people that it deals with. Is RAND feeling any of that sort of thing?
The political pressure?
Right.
I'm sure we're conscious of it, but you put it in the contracting bin, as if this were, we would get or not get a contract, depending on our outlook on the world situation.
Yeah, DOD has couched it rather bluntly in those terms sometimes, but I think...
Yeah. SDI, for example,
right.
How we view that and so on. That I think that could happen, and I'm sure we're conscious of it, yet we do work for SDIO. We have work ongoing now. I'm really not in a position to comment on the way politics influences our contracting or our research, for that matter. I don't think that we let our research get mixed up. I have lived through some, difficult times at RAND where politics did play a big part in the Vietnam War. We used to have people with placards walking around RAND. We had the Ellsberg situation, the New York Times letter situation. We had our own research people at odds about some of this. But I can't give a simple answer to the question of politics. Our social scientists seem to be most keenly aware of these things. The engineers probably could care less how it goes. The economists would be sharp on it. But, so I guess I have to end on a doubtful way about that.
Okay, it's a big, difficult question.
Yeah.
I didn't expect an easy answer to it.
Right.
Well, why don't we go ahead
yeah.
and call it quits here.
Good,
thanks.
Thank you.